BuzzFeed at almost $1 billion. How do you suppose that happens? The big business of humanitarian assistance and the race and class divide in the cosmetics aisle as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 11th of August. Glad, as always, to have you here, everybody. There are all kinds of cheap and quick and easy ways to set up our lead story today. The news that BuzzFeed, it of the silly listicles and ridiculous quizzes, has gotten new venture capital funding from a firm called Andreessen Horowitz that values it at $850 million. But no, we are not going to do the cheap, quick, and easy setup because $850 million is real money. So instead, we are going to go the real money route. How is BuzzFeed worth that much, and what might it mean? Marketplace's Queen of Kim gets us going.
BuzzFeed boasts that 150 million people visit it every month. By contrast, the New York Times gets about 55 million visitors. Paul Sweeney is an analyst at Bloomberg Industries, and he says it's not just the number of visits that's valuable, but who's visiting. Most of BuzzFeed's audience is 35 and under, a demographic that's catnip to advertisers.
It's been harder and harder for advertisers to reach younger demographics. The younger folks are the ones that are spending more time on the internet, more time off of traditional media like newspapers or magazines or television.
A lot of BuzzFeed's traffic comes from people sharing its stories on social media sites. Sweeney says that strategy is risky. BuzzFeed's audience would be decimated if social media sites excluded its content. Ethan Kurzweil is with Bessemer Venture Partners. He says investors are betting that BuzzFeed will go beyond listicles and become the go-to platform that offers all kinds of content, videos, news, and who knows what else.
I assume they're betting on a modern media tech company, sort of a modern People magazine, ESPN, all in one property.
In fact, BuzzFeed is using its newest round of funding to expand into movies. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst at the Altimeter Group. She says don't expect BuzzFeed to compete with 20th Century Fox or Paramount by making traditional movies.
I really don't think that's going to be the case.
Lieb predicts BuzzFeed will redefine movies and create ones that cater to its digital-first audience. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
You can add Disney to the growing list of companies with which Amazon is on the outs. Hachette, the book publisher you already know about. Now, some of Disney's DVDs and Blu-rays aren't being made available for pre-order on Amazon. It's a spat that has become very, very public. Tracy Samuelson looks at the negotiating tactics in play.
If this were a Disney movie, some would cast Amazon as the bad guy, like the evil fairy Maleficent. Others would say it's a Captain America-esque hero, fighting for lower prices for consumers. By the way, the discs of those new Disney films are currently unavailable for pre-order on Amazon. But Ed Bordeaux, the author of Negotiation Bootcamp, says Amazon's tactics aren't good or bad. They're business. Amazon, like all companies its size, is flexing its muscle to get the best deals possible.
That's what people do in negotiation all the time. They use their leverage. And Amazon has a tremendous amount of leverage.
Michael Pachter with Wedbush Securities says we see this with companies like Walmart all the time.
Walmart pays as low a price as anybody wholesale for any product that it sells, and it is able to do so by exercising its market muscle. Amazon is trying very hard to be Walmart-like.
Pachter says pre-sales are a big deal for Disney because it will impact their first-day sales ranking. But he doubts customers will mind much. Michael Norris, an independent publishing and media consultant, thinks Amazon is being a bully. He's surprised it's risking its reputation with customers.
A company that claims to be very customer-centric finds absolutely nothing wrong with inconveniencing millions of consumers.
But whatever deal Amazon and its vendors eventually reach, the public nature of their dispute means they might not be riding off into the sunset together anytime soon. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
It was a moderately enthusiastic start to the working week on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, you guys know the drill. There There was some amazing footage today on CNN from inside an Iraqi Air Force helicopter delivering relief supplies to Yazidi refugees and then taking some of those refugees on board and getting them out. Truly amazing pictures. ISIS and its rapid advance has put the Yazidis out of reach of the industry that normally provides food and water and shelter to vulnerable people worldwide. It is the humanitarian aid industry, a $22 billion a year business and growing. It employs more than 250,000 people and got record amounts of donor contributions last year. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
I didn't realize I'd get double wrap on this one.
International Medical Corps, a non-governmental organization based in Los Angeles, has just moved to new offices, partly to save on rent. Margaret Aguirre, the head of global initiatives, is unwrapping her photographs. One shows mothers and children outside of an IMC clinic in Ethiopia a few years ago during a hunger crisis.
It didn't reach to the level of famine, but it was very close, and we were seeing a lot of starving children, and it was a very difficult time.
Another more recent photo Aguirre took in South Sudan.
All of these women and children have just come off a bus. These are people whose homes were bombed in the conflict to the north. It's said all the time, it sounds like a cliche, but when your home is bombed, you run.
International Medical Corps responds to emergencies, deploying doctors to disaster areas and training local health workers. It started in 1984 as a handful of volunteer doctors and nurses who traveled to Afghanistan on their own dime to treat wounded people. This year, it has a budget of $300 million and nearly 5,000 employees working in 30 countries. Visit its website and you'll find more than 100 job openings. And there are thousands of NGOs, says Abby Stoddard of Humanitarian Outcomes, a firm that researches humanitarian assistance.
Roughly 5,000, but the number rises and falls each year, and a lot of new NGOs will be created around a given emergency and then disappear again.
There are more than 250,000 people working in aid, and Stoddard says the sector has professionalized.
You can even get master's degrees in humanitarian assistance. These could be technical specialists in water and sanitation or food assistance. They could be logisticians, financial analysts, program managers. There's a whole raft of careers within international humanitarian aid.
Jessica Alexander, who has two master's degrees and has done everything from managing camps for displaced people to working with former child soldiers, says sometimes people mistake aid work for charity. She wrote a book called Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid, to clear up some of the misconceptions.
People have come up to me at this point in my career and say, gosh, how can you afford to continue volunteering? And what they don't understand is that this very much is a career, and we're paid well, and we're paid with benefits.
There's even a kind of career ladder. William Easterly, who teaches economics at NYU and wrote the book The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, has seen a huge increase in the number of students pursuing careers in aid. Many will start out in NGOs.
Salaries are going to be very low in most NGOs. You know, they are small and operating on a pretty limited budget. There's also a big phenomenon in NGOs of unpaid interns. And part of this is just supply and demand. There's a huge amount of supply of young people who do want to work in development, and that's great. But there's just not enough jobs for them.
But working for an NGO can get you a foot in the door at the UN.
Young people can get more decent salaries at UN agencies or other official aid agencies like the World Bank.
The money for those salaries comes from the donations of governments, foundations, companies, and individuals. Last year, donors gave a record $22 billion that covered aid distribution, programs, really everything. But there's a big difference between aid and other growth industries. More jobs, more money, more demand usually means more crises. International Medical Corps' Margaret Aguirre.
We've been doing this for 30 years, and I can honestly say that there are more crises, there are more conflicts, there are more disasters, there are a lot of people in peril, and it seems like there's a crisis everywhere.
In addition to Iraq, there are humanitarian crises in Syria, South Sudan, the Gaza Strip, and across Central Africa. There is even, according to the U.S. government, a humanitarian crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, sparked by children and families fleeing Central America. All of it could add up to another growth year for the aid industry. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
So you join a new company, you are all excited, and then at some point in your first couple of weeks, you have to do new employee orientation. With apologies to all of my colleagues working in human resources, it is rarely the most exciting set of lectures. Am I right? That is why an article in the New York Times today caught our eye about how they do things at Apple. It's something called Apple University. Brian Chen wrote the piece. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
I have to say, this article almost makes corporate indoctrination at Apple sound fun and interesting.
You know, the people I talk to say it's like fancy business school. They're really impressed with this course. I mean, it's called Apple University, and it's an internal training program started by Steve Jobs. And yeah, they're super fascinated by it. They're usually pretty pumped to take these classes.
The example, the key example you give in this article is the, I guess, reductiveness of Apple design, right? They use the bull drawing by Picasso, a very famous set of drawings by Picasso, where he gets a sketch of a bull down to like four lines or something. And then the comparison is made between that and the Apple mouse, which now comes almost buttonless, I guess, right?
Yeah, that was a course I heard about. It was really, really interesting. It was called Communicating at Apple. Hmm. They like to start out with an idea and whittle it down as much as possible until it speaks just clearly enough for the consumer or whoever is receiving the message to understand how to use the product or what the message is exactly. So they do this also in their product marketing and their commercials. It's just the general way that they try to teach employees to think about communicating.
You know, for all the credit that Apple and Jobs get and got for being iconoclasts and doing things their own way, they go out and they hire a business professor from the Yale School of Management. You don't get much more mainstream than that, right? This guy who set up Apple University.
Right. This training program is a lot more extensive than pretty much every other corporate training program I've heard of. Other companies have training programs too. Like, say, for example, Facebook will train the engineers on the coding for programming, that is. Hmm. And I just haven't heard of something this extensive where they hire somebody like Joel, who's one of the star people from Yale.
Joel Padolny, the guy who did this, yeah.
Yeah. And then he hires an entire faculty of prestigious professors from places like Stanford, Berkeley, MIT, and so on. Overall, it's much more extensive than I've seen from other companies.
Of course, there's a case to be made that we all ought to just get over ourselves and stop, you know, covering every nano thing that Apple ever does, right?
True. I mean, I thought I really enjoyed doing this story because, you know, it gets kind of tiresome. Like, I've been writing about Apple for at least 7 years. Oof. And each time, you know, whenever there's a big, quote unquote, scoop coming in about Apple, it's about, oh, the new iPhone has a faster processor or it has a bigger screen. And to me, it's like, no, duh, of course it's going to. This is a company that is trying to continue to evolve as it gets bigger. And it tells us something really fascinating about how much of an effort it is to preserve its legacy as, you know, the biggest tech company in the world right now. So it was really fun to do.
Brian Chen at the New York Times. Brian, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Coming up,
it's a problem that 80% of black men and women have, and it's a problem that 30% of men and women of other races have.
What is pseudofolliculitis barbae, Alex? But first, let's do the numbers. Well, yes, indeed. It is August, I think. The Dow Industrial's up a whopping 16 points. We'll call that a 10%, 16,569 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ popped up 30.7%, ended things at 4,401. The S&P 500 nudged up 5 points, about a quarter percent, ended things at 19.36. Priceline Group negotiated a 2% gain. Get it? Priceline negotiated 2% gain. After the company reported a 26% rise in second quarter revenue, Expedia booked up 1.6% today. Orbitz stepped up a quarter of 1%. Chiquita Brands, they of the bananas, jumped 30% on the news that a Brazilian juice firm offered to buy the company for about $600 million. Insulin drug maker Mankind rose nearly 5% today after French company Sanofi agreed to pay just shy of $1 billion for a global rights deal. Markets were all higher overseas, by the by. Both the FTSE in London and the CAC 40 in Paris lifted more than 1% today. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, since you asked, rose to 2.42%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for June. On August 12, 1988, The Last Temptation of Christ opened in a limited number of theaters. The Martin Scorsese-directed film drew moviegoers and protesters. And drag your sleeping bag out back. It's your annual opportunity to wish upon a star. The Perseid meteor shower is at its peak. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today's important but potentially deadly boring business news story comes to us courtesy of the pipeline conglomerate Kinder Morgan. It's consolidating, buying out three of its affiliated companies in a $44 billion deal, in the process taking advantage of a specific kind of business relationship called a master limited partnership and its tax benefits. Kinder and its composite parts owns a huge network of oil and gas pipelines in North America, and now they are going to be buying more. Kate Davidson explains.
Kinder Morgan already operates or owns a piece of some 80,000 miles of pipelines. But Barbara Shook with the Energy Intelligence Group says its founder clearly wants more.
Mr. Kinder kept talking about acquisitions and acquisitions and acquisitions during the conference call with analysts this morning.
Shook, by the way, owns shares in one of the Kinder Morgan companies. She says the corporate restructuring will make it cheaper for Kinder Morgan to borrow money. That's money it can use to buy a precious commodity, other pipeline companies.
We're caught short in terms of our transportation infrastructure for energy.
Bob McNally is president of the Rapidan Group. He says the U.S. oil and gas boom changed everything, both the scale of the boom and where it's happening.
Parts of the country where we're increasing production of oil and gas are not areas where we produced oil and gas before.
Think of all that natural gas in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, or the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. Energy security expert Paul Sullivan at Georgetown University says there aren't enough pipelines to move it all.
I think the proof that there is need for more is the amount of oil that is moving by rail.
He says so much oil is moving by rail that corn and other agricultural goods are getting squeezed out, and derailments have a devastating effect.
Moving oil by rail is more expensive, and it's also less safe.
Which is why companies like Kinder Morgan want to lay the groundwork for more pipelines. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We've been bringing you stories off and on for a while now about how the oil boom in North Dakota is changing things out there. It's a series called Black Gold Boom by independent producer Todd Melby. One of the larger-than-life figures in western North Dakota is a billionaire named Harold Hamm. He's the CEO of the region's biggest oil producer. It's called Continental Resources. And then there's Phil Hamm, who is not exactly larger than life, but he's lived in the boomtown of Williston for a long time, since long before it was a boomtown.
And that's my remote-controlled airplane helicopter. My name is Phil Hamm.
Did you know that about this other Hamm, this Harold Hamm?
Yeah, I've heard about him, but he's no relation that I know of.
That guy's got billions.
Yeah, I know it. He's got billions, and I got zeros. I was paying rent at $200 a month. They raised it to $850. And I live on Social Security, $900 a month. How do I do that? I was actually sick to my stomach and everything from... What do? No place to go. I can't live on the street. But I would have had to. I would have done it. But I've never been that way. Never been down that low before. So it was kind of hard. You could take it a little bit easy on the old people. You don't have to take and try to run them out of here. Why run them out? They were here before the oil. Why should they have to run out of here?
Were you living in Williston before the oil boom?
Yes, I was. It kind of went to pot when the oil came here. I go up here to Harmon Park, sit there in the gazebo and watch these goddamn guys sit there and drink their beer. I mean, you know, that ain't no good. I was born on a chicken farm in Menominee, Wisconsin. If you know where that's at. Married my wife, but she had eight kids, And all our kids were in the Dakotas, so that's how we ended up here. And she passed away in Rapid City about 20 years ago. I've been kind of kicking it around by myself. I'm 77, and I ain't got too many more years left here. And I wish it was back to the old part, old Williston. I really do. What happens if the oil leaves? Remember, it did it once before. It'll do it again.
Todd's series, Black Gold Boom, is a project from Prairie Public and the Association for Independence in Radio. We started today talking about the $50 million that Andreessen Horowitz, the venture capital firm, is going to plow into BuzzFeed. We will end with another Silicon Valley business Andreessen Horowitz is backing called Walker & Company. Its founder, a guy named Tristan Walker, once worked at Andreessen Horowitz. He ran business development for Foursquare as well. Now he is trying to build what has been called the Procter & Gamble for people of color. Product number one is a new line of shaving products. It's called Bevel. Tristan, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
You have to help me understand how you go from being Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur guy to a lifestyle company.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like solving problems, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Walker & Company, we're in the business of solving problems that exist in the health and beauty space. You know, our first brand tackles a very, very important problem that exists in the kind of, African-American community. And something I wanted to solve. And, you know, Silicon Valley is all about solving those problems. And I think we have the opportunity to do something pretty special.
What's the actual problem?
Yeah. So for 15 years, this is my personal story. Yeah. You know, I wasn't able to shave, right? Every single way that I encountered facial hair removal was terrible. I used a multi-blade razor on my face when I was about 15. I woke up the following morning completely broken out, right? Only to realize that it was a function of my having coarse curly hair and those multi-blade razors cutting the hair beneath my skin. And the way that I kind of did it for about 14 years, I put a depilatory cream on my face. So these are creams
like Nair,
that contain...
right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. It has all these hazardous, harsh chemicals. It stinks up your bathroom. it's just terrible. And we've developed, again, the first and only solution to fix this issue for folks like me.
And you have decided, as the first product launch out of the box, this brand, this line you're calling Bevel, it is shaving products for African-American men.
Well, so Bevel is the first and only shaving system designed specifically for men with coarse, curly hair.
Got it.
It's the best way for anyone to shave, period. You know, we're going after or solving this problem, pseudofolliculitis barbae. It's, you know, razor bumps and razor burn,
right?
It's a problem that 80% of black men and women have. And it's a problem that 30% of men and women of other races have. And, you know, we're doing it with really beautiful design, great product, and an educational experience, you know, to teach folks the right way to shave.
I want you to take this question in the spirit with which it's intended, all right? And I'm reflecting back, actually, a little bit of what you have said in the media about Bevel and about Walker & Company. There are many, many, many issues facing the African-American community in this country, the community of color in this country. I don't know how high up on the list shaving ranks.
Again, it's not about shaving, right? It's about developing brands and products that work, that inspire the community to really be proud of, right? You know, I reflect back on my experience of going to, you know, a retail shop, you know, and having to go to the ethnic aisle, right? That's not really an aisle. It's a shelf. Then I have to reach to the bottom of that shelf for a package that's dirty. And then the joke that we like to say internally, you know, there's a photo of like a 65-year-old bald black gentleman in a towel on it, right? Like that entire second-class citizen experience is just, it's not great, right? You know, considering, you know, how much money we spend on these things, how much need we have for products that work, I think having a respect for the customer is incredibly important.
Tristan Walker. He's the head of his own company. It's called Walker & Company, and their new product, Bevel. Tristan, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I think fits nicely under the category heading Caveat Emptor, the World Customs Organization, an international association of, yes, just like it sounds, customs and law enforcement agencies, is out with its annual report on seizures of illegal goods and counterfeiting. The product most likely to be counterfeited or illegally traded last year? Pharmaceuticals by a mile, a whopping 76% of all seizures. The most counterfeited brand, on the other hand? Nike, followed by Apple, Rolex, Samsung, and Adidas. And with that, we are out of here. Today, the Dow hiked up 16 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq popped up about 30.7%. The S&P 500 nudged 5 points higher, a quarter of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.